Session number 31072, Reel 1.
Well, my name is Tom O'Reilly, but during my wartime career, more or less known as Paddy, I never got the Thomas, it was always a Paddy. I served with 274, 229, 122 and 603 squadrons, so four different squadrons. I was very fortunate in having operational experience on Spitfires, Hurricanes, Mustangs and Typhoons, so I had quite a wide range of experience.
Thomas, can you tell me about the day you joined up? What it felt like,
putting
your name down.
I'm finding it rather difficult catching what you're saying.
Thomas, can you tell me what it felt like the day you signed up?
Well, joining the forces.
Yeah.
Well, at that particular time, I think the war had just started then, and of course everybody was bags of publicity going on and propaganda, you know, book your seat for Berlin and all that kind of stuff. And teenagers as we were then, the thing was we had to get in the forces. We wanted to kind of partake. So, and the glamour job then, of course, was flying. And the ideal, of course, was the fighter pilot. Everybody thought fighter pilot was the kind of the glamour role. So that was the one I went after. Well, with aircrew, you volunteered initially for aircrew. And then you were segregated then. It depended on how you performed during the various tests that went on during your career. And the instructors kind of segregated you. Initially, one went through as a pilot. If for every 100 flights, I would say, falling by the wayside, you'd get about 20% within the first month who would drop off and fail in one way or the other. So gradually the flight of 100 was whittled down. Some were taken off and went down to navigators. If they failed the various training sequences, they went to the next job, which was navigating, and if they failed that, they went to wireless off air gunners and so on. When one eventually went on to flying training as a pilot, if you got that far, you'd done what you call an EFTS, which was an elementary flying training. Everybody got exactly the same, but after the completion of that, you're more or less qualified with your instructors to be segregated to either fighter command or bomber command. It depended entirely on how you performed and how they thought you were suited. If they thought you were more suited to a fighter command type, you'd be segregated. Naturally, everybody, the kind of the number one league was fighters. It, like, if you can imagine it similar to football divisions, the Premier Division, the Second Division and Third Division, everybody wanted to be a fighter pilot, but not everybody made it. So gradually they were whittled down. Those who didn't make fighters went to bombers. Those who didn't make bombers finished up on coastal command and so on, transport command. Initially in South Africa, the actual flying training in South Africa with the South African Air Force, we were unfortunate in so much as at the end of your pilot's training, and you were presented with your wings, other colleagues in different areas of training, like America or in England, at the end of the completion, they got the wings, they went on a leave. But unfortunately, we were in South Africa, so you couldn't very well have a leave. We missed out on that. We went straight then up to the Middle East. Being in South Africa, our nearest theatre of war was the desert. Well, you'd have two courses. You'd have initial training, and when you went onto the EFTS, say your morning would probably be on lectures. You'd have lectures on various things like navigation, meteorology, aerodrome control, all that kind of the ground subjects. And then in the afternoon, the same flight would then go on to flying training. So you'd fly all afternoon. The following week, it might be in reverse. The morning you'd do flying, and afternoon. And then periodically, I think it was about every month during your training, you had to sit an exam. And you had to pass that exam. If you didn't pass the exam, you were off. Well, in South Africa, there was a peculiar thing because they had a organisation called the Ossova Bronwick, who were pro-German. And it was difficult because one would never know who they were. And when you were actually training, our instructors told us, for instance, when we were coming back to camp, if we went out into town and going back to the aerodrome, walking along the road, they'd say if they saw a car coming, get off the road, move back, because if the Oxford Brown was there, the bad habit they had was running off and hitting, running into the blokes, knocking them into the ditch, and we had more lads in Robert's Heights, the military hospital there, with being knocked over by these OBs, as they call them, than Soft Joe. But the South Africans themselves, the pro-British South Africans, they were great. And weekends we used to go into Johannesburg and we'd have like what you call a talk-age. You'd have civilians who would volunteer to be guests or to take a couple of the servicemen for the weekend. And they were very hospitable, very hospitable. And the food was good stuff, you know, I mean, because they weren't affected by the war, there was no blackout or nothing like that. And everything was first class. Yes, well, that was in the SFTS. In South Africa, you do your flying training, you'd have quite a few rather notable occurrences, you know. At one particular time, I know I had to land with undercarriage up because I flew through an electric storm. In South Africa, the electrical storms were very, very fierce. And I was doing a three-legged cross-country. And I had no alternative other than to fly right through this storm. Otherwise, I'd have lost my bearings doing a navigational trip. And it affected all the electrical systems on the aircraft. And the undercarriage was indicated as down, but in fact it wasn't down, it was just flopping. And I came and landed. And I landed actually when a wings parade, the senior course, was doing a rehearsal. So I had quite a few spectators, so I'd be coming with undercarriage up. So, but it was fortunately for me, when it was taken into the hangar, it found that the electrical system had gone and I was blameless. So I didn't drop a clanger that way. In England, it was quite a big thing. Your parents would be invited to them. Well, as you can understand, obtaining your wings was quite some achievement. And in South Africa, of course, you haven't got your parents there. But I did make friends with people in Johannesburg, and they invited them down. They came to the Wings Parade. And you always had a notable, but one never knew who it was that was going to present the wings. It was either the AOC for the area, Air Officer Commanding, or a fairly well high-up diplomat. But in our particular case, we were lucky, and it was the Johnny Smuts, who was the Prime Minister himself. You know, it was quite a big thing. We were very, very fortunate, very chuffed. You know. Well, we went down through Durban then, and all then posted up through the Middle East. We went to an OTU called, what was it called, the name of the camp? Oh, not Littleton. It was near the Sweetwater Canal. Ismailia. And near the Sweetwater Canal. And that was the OTU. We'd done an operational training unit there. From there then, various boys, some went on to, who weren't patients, they went on to aircraft delivery units. But those who wanted to stick out for squadrons, we were kept behind. And eventually then we were posted to 274 Squadron. Your working day, during the war, unfortunately, there was no relaxation, put it that way. Every day of the week was exactly the same. There was no weekends. There was no holidays. And your working day was down to dispersal A and B flights. Then the operational duties would be phoned through to dispersal. You'd have two aircraft on immediate readiness. You'd have two on 15 minutes, two on 30 minutes and so on. You'd have two aircraft on immediate readiness. You'd have two on 15 minutes, two on 30 minutes and so on. And then after about around about 9 o'clock in the morning, the immediate readiness would start about dawn. You know, it might be 4:30 or 5:30, something like that. But around about 9 o'clock, the rest of the squadron pilots would be at dispersal. And then the operational for the days would be phoned through and they'd be briefed and away they went. Then you'd fly all day, you'd break for lunch, you'd come back, have your lunch, then carry on. But as soon as the lights faded, that was the end of it. You finished flying for the day. Of course, with single engine fighter, you couldn't fly at night. Well, you could fly, but you wouldn't want to. And that was every weekend then. It was worked out that a pilot from A and a pilot from B squadron, plus their crew, that is their flight engineer, their flight airframes, their instrument basher, their armourer, making a group of about five or six, they'd have a weekend pass. And we'd all go then into Alexandria. And we'd have a weekend in Alexandria, and then, but it'd change every single weekend, it'd change. Well, you'd stay with your friends, so you'd break up, you'd stay with your friend, and then you'd have a particular time for coming back, you'd have a transport back to the squadron. But you had various clubs and the like that were laid on for the forces in Alexandria for respite, you know, the nine times. The main thing you'd do, as soon as you went in there, you went into the hotel and you made sure you had a bloody good shower and got shut of all the sand and all the muck and had a good meal. And then, of course, you just relax, and most of the time you spent was drinking. Well, with 274 Squadron, originally we were flying Hurricane 2Cs. The thing there was, it was like being thrown in the deep end, in so much as when you're on training OTU, you flew Hurricanes as a trainer, but you didn't fly overload tanks. When you went onto a squadron, you flew Hurricanes with two overload tanks, 45 gallon tanks. And the thing is, when you first joined the squadron, there was three of us, and the first thing our CO said to us, "I presume you want some operational hours." And of course, everybody wanted to have operational hours in the logbook. And he said, "Have you flown with overload tanks?" We said, "No." He said, so he took us out to the aircraft, showed us where it was, and very briefly he said, "Right." He said, "There's your selectors there," which was new to us then. He said, "You'll take off on your main tanks." I'm just trying to think of what the system was now. Take off the main tanks, and then after getting airborne, after flying, I think it's about 1,000 foot, something like that, you'd switch on to either your port or your starboard tank. Then you'd switch off your main tank, and then you'd exhaust your tank, whatever tank you went on to, for 45 minutes. Then you'd go back onto your main tank again, switch off and go on to the other one and switch off again. And it was a rather complicated system. He said, "Have you got it now?" And of course we said, "Oh yeah, we have, you know." He said, "Well, Paddy at 40, he said, you go on readiness tomorrow." I said, "Okay." And lo and behold, as we were also on readiness, we got a scramble, which meant we were operational. And I've never held my breath so much in all my life. We took off all right, and I was thinking, now, what the hell was it he said? You know, what system was it? We turn off this, the channel. And you'd never actually turned your main tank off anyway. And I must confess, when I was hoping I got it right, I turned onto my tank, and then I held my breath and switched off my main tank, expected the engine to stop, but it didn't. And I was very much relieved, you know. But it was quite a big thing switching that main tank off for the first time, you know. Particular, the first operational trip I did, there was only two of us, and we were doing a convoy patrol in the Mediterranean. And at that particular time, the Navy lads were trigger happy. And when you approached a convoy, you flew the colours of the day. When you approached a convoy, you approached from a certain angle, you flew your colours of the day, which was accepted by the convoy. If you didn't, whether they recognise you or not, they'd let go at you, they'd fire at you, you know. So you have to fire you. And I was following my number one, and at that particular time, I think I must have aged about, how old would I be then? I mean, just turned 18, I think, something like that. And I must have, in the next 20 minutes or so, I become 98, because there was some, I think it was Hamdens, I'm not quite sure whether Hamdens or Blenheims, were coming from Sicily, had done on a bombing raid, and it looked very much like Junkers 88. And my number one said, "Bandits, 9 o'clock below, Metros." We looked down, and there was these things flying straight towards the convoy. And he said, "You know, you gun switches on, which meant we were going into action. Well, at that particular period of affair, I went from a 18-year-old to about a 98-year-old. And fortunately, when we went down on them anyway, they were Blenheim. So he said, going down, we have to follow down, and gun switches on, we're ready to get involved. And he said, break. Suddenly, there were Blenheims, you know, and they hadn't spotted the convoy. Otherwise, they'd have been fired at, so they diverted. I went down there, just convoy patrols then, and if there was any tank busting jobs, originally 2Ds, we went on to Hurricane 2Ds then, which were the tank busters. With the 2D, we had 45mm cannons, two cannons out of the wing. They were the same calibre as your mobile anti-aircraft guns that used to go around the streets firing. Well, they were same weight as them. So you can imagine on an aircraft, they were quite heavy. And the thing is, you'd fire your 40mm cannon shell, and the main aim is to hit a tank. It'd turn a tank over, to start off with. And it was always a fairly low-level attack. Now, in the desert, unfortunately, with the sand, you could get what you call stoppages in the breech block. And it had a devastating effect on the 2D, because if you're firing one and you're getting a repercussion from both main planes, and all of a sudden one stops, that main plane accelerates. And it accelerates very rapidly, very quickly. And you're not very high up, so you've got to be on the ball. As soon as it stops, you feel it going, you've got to be quick and hit. Opposite rudder and fly him on his cockeye to level it out. But you could turn a tank over and things like that. And we'd do convoy patrol. And anything, tanks and the like, a 40mm would turn a tank over. When you were kept busy, you never had time to reflect on things. That was one blessing. I mean, people often say, were you frightened? Well, you don't have time to be frightened, because you've got that much to do. In a fighter aircraft, you're your own air gunner, your own wireless operator, your own navigator, your own man band. You do everything for yourself. And if you get clobbered, it's your own fault. You can't blame anybody else. So it kept you going all the time. The only time you ever reflect is when I'm diverting a little bit now. This is a few years later on, when we were at Coltishall, and we were doing Spitz 16 then, on 603 Squadron, and we were dive bombing the V2 sites. But occasionally we'd have a bomber escort, and we'd have squadrons visiting the aerodrome. And when you have squadrons visiting the aerodrome, they usually put on a show. You know, they come in fancy flying and things like that. And this particular time we were waiting, watching all these lads coming in who were flying with us later on. And one of them hit a shelter with an overhead tank on and blew up. And it was right alongside where our dispersal was, and we all rushed out afterwards. And it wasn't a particularly nice sight, to be perfectly frank, because the poor lad killed himself. And with foam, the blood tub and the fire tent had gone there, splashed it all with foam, and it hit his head on the gun sight. So there was a bit of a mess and foam, and it was a bit mucky. Well, this happened, say, at 4 o'clock. 6 o'clock, we're all sitting in the aircraft after having tea, waiting for the cartridge to be sent from flying control, telling us to get ready and start engines to go on the bomber. And that particular time, when you're sitting there waiting, and it's just kind of just dusk, everything's quiet, even the birds seem to stop singing, you know. And I suddenly thought, what the bloody hell am I doing here, you know. You suddenly have time to think, you know. You start thinking about things. But that's the only time, you know, you ever kind of worry about what you're doing. In actual fact, we were very, how do you put it? I wouldn't say we were snobbish and things like that, but there was a language barrier.
Yeah.
And when we were at Pathos, for instance, we used to go out. I mean, the squadron doc, he was the only one with transport. We had a jeep. And in fact, on the jeep, there used to be about 8 of us all clambering up the jeep. You'd be sitting on the mud guard and all over the place. And he used to just drive us into Cyprus. And basically all we ever did then was just sit and drink. If I remember, the local brew was, I think it was called Commanderia local brew, and it used to be about, I don't know, 1 and 9 months old coinage for a bloody litre bottle, you know. We used to swallow about 3 or 4 of these things, so we were all boss-eyed, you know, by the time we came back to camp, you know. And I suppose when you think about it, half the time the next day we'd be flying and we'd still be having a hangover. you see the old cockpit covers coming back and oxygen masks going off because oxygen excuse me, getting a lungful of that used to kind of clear your head, and then you'd stick your mask back on. When you were flying, you'd know who was suffering with a hangover. You'd see the cockpit slide back and you'd say, oh, he's sorting himself out. But we were still 3 parts inebriated when we used to fly the next day. And we're all suffering with hangovers, you know. Well, to be perfectly frank, it didn't affect us much because we were so much in a group. We were so much together in a squadron, you know. I mean, we never seemed to go outside the squadron itself, and even when we went outside anyway, the squadron went en masse, all 3 or 4 pilots would be together and they'd stay in a group, you know. But it was self-induced shelter, not necessarily sheltered ourselves, but we used to kind of keep to ourselves, you know. That was very enjoyable because we had nothing at all to do, and we were quite near Tunis. We were at a place called Satif. We were at a place called Hammam Plaza, not Satif. Hammam Plaza, which is just outside Tunis. And we used to have a whole length of the beach, which was cordoned off. We used to have Italian POWs, even stopping the locals from going on our beach. So our beach was secluded for us. And we used to go swimming and things like that. We'd use little hand grenades for fish. I shouldn't do it, I know, but you kind of throw stuff on the sea, you bring the fish in and you just lob a grenade in and they go boof, and then next thing it all floats up and we pick them out, you know. Wouldn't even bother to fish them, we'd just pick them out. But we'd have, every now and again, we'd have a dance, and the Naffy girls and any local RAC or ATS who might be in headquarters in Tunis, they used to be invited and they used to come out, and it used to be quite a pleasant time, really. Well, once you've done a tour, you're entitled to relax and get away from it all, kind of thing, and recuperate, I suppose, re-energise, whatever you'd like to call it, before you went on a second tour. So you had a period in a rest camp. Well, on the course, actually, I finished on Hurricane. I went to the aircrew rest camp, and then I was then posted to Satif. And at Satif, we were doing what you call the cockpit drill for Free French Air, FFI, Free French. And we were giving them the Hurricane cockpit layout and sending them off solo. They were coming off Kitterhawks and Tomahawks onto Hurricane. Excuse me. And then while I was there, I transferred across the aerodrome to another portion of the aerodrome, which was spit conversion onto Spitz, and that's how I managed to convert onto Spitz. And I started a second tour then on Spitz, so that's how I managed to get across. But while I was on at Satif, I got to know a couple of the Free French lads. If I can remember, one was Jeremiah was one, can't remember the other lad's name, but I think they're both from Marseille, I'm not sure. But I used to go with them occasionally. We used to go into Satif itself, and there used to be some French residents who were living in North Africa, you know, and they'd go to these houses and have coffee or whatever, you know. I used to go with them now and again, you know. But again, I must confess I was lazy. I took French at school, but the minute I left school, I forgot it, and I never bothered, you know. And of course they were speaking French, I couldn't I could catch, 9 times out of 10 I could catch what they were saying, but I couldn't speak it myself. We were always made welcome. We were always made welcome wherever we went, particularly in England. more than ever. When we came back and after the invasion D-Day, and if we were on leave, I had a couple of leaves in London, and all the London people were great, you know. They make quite a fuss of you, you know. Never on the receiving end, but I mean, the old V1s were flying across, you know. You could see the old V1s. Well, we used to chase the V1s anyway. We, as well as doing the convoy patrols and the beachhead patrols, we'd also be scrambled anti-V. There used to be a system of a ring around London. So many miles area would be ACAC. From then on, for another couple of miles area, would be fighter. From then on, it'd be ACAC. It'd be split to system. And in fact, you could be scrambled after a V1, a buzz bomb. And you could go after, but you have to make sure that you didn't run into the wrong area. Otherwise, the ACAC could have a go at you as well. Well, they wouldn't have a go at you, but they'd fire at the buzz bomb and they could hit you. But we used to go after buzz bombs and the like. So the only experience we had, not on none actually landed near where I was, but occasionally you'd hear them going and you could see them going across, you know. And they'd cut out and then next minute, boof, they'd go off somewhere, you know, but fortunately not where I was. Well, you took it in your stride. You got to accept it. It didn't have any effect on you, you know, because you had the chip on your shoulder anyway, and you knew who the enemy was, kind of thing, so you had to go at them anyway. But we never actually saw... I never saw any actual happen. I never got there when the smoke was still floating around and things like that. It was always well and truly finished, so it was just ruins when I saw it. It was just looking at a ruin, you know. It's been over and done with. It happened before I got there, kind of thing. So it never had an effect in that regard. I was lucky, really, because I managed to land undercarriage up. When you're landing in the desert, you were trained that if you had time, you'd look around and you'd look for a dark spot. If you could find a dark spot, that means there's some stones underneath, or it's reasonably solid underneath. Landing in the desert is like landing in water. It's very, very, very dicey. Very dicey, because you wouldn't roll, you'd just stop. Same in water, you'd just stop. And you'd always look and try and find a place. I was lucky that the second time was... The first time wasn't too bad, because I managed to make glide onto a flat, what you call an air firing range. So it was fairly solid when I landed. And then it wheels up, but I landed and it was all right. But the second time it happened that quick, I never had time to look around, because I was only about 200 feet up. And you go through your system that quick, automatically, you know, you switch your engine off, you lock your seat belt, you pull your goggles down. You have to pull your goggles down because of the sand and the like are getting the eyes everywhere. And I just had time to put out a mayday before I was, and I didn't even have time to look around and find the spot. I had to go down where I was, and they hit the top of a sand hill and took the top of a sand hill away altogether. I managed to float off and land on my belly the other side. It took the rudder off altogether, but it's just a bloody big cloud of sand, you know. And George Myers, who was flying number two, he said he saw me go down. It was funny when he thought about it. He says he saw the aircraft go down and he saw a big cloud of smoke. He didn't know whether the smoke was sand. He said, and he saw a little figure come running out with a parachute stuck behind him, and me going like the cloud. You have to get out quick, because you don't know whether you're landing right side up or upside down or what, but you pull your goggles down, you see blue sky, so you know you're okay. Knock your door down and out you go. And then when you find, even though you got your goggles down and your oxygen mask on, you've still got sand up your nose and in your eyes, you've got sand everywhere. Terrible. Well, you wouldn't want to hang around too long. It depends where you lost them. Well, I done a gym crawl the first time. You have it happen, but 9 times out of 10, if someone was clubbed, it's happened and you haven't seen it, because you're too busy yourself looking after yourself. But the only time I had, twice actually, I was able to think about it. I had heard people say the flak was that close you could hear it. I thought, well, they were exaggerating, but in fact